This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses. Hey guys, good morning. Welcome back to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast. I always say good morning because that's when I'm recording this, but good afternoon or good evening to whenever you're listening to this. And today is another episode in my series of tackling what you need to do to file lien in all 50 states. And today we're talking about Colorado. And so the whole purpose of this project is to break down, you know, how to have a valid lien in all 50 states. And because there are lien rights in all 50 states, but they're all different. And so if we can dive in and know what they are on the front end and the steps that you have to take. So today I have the resident expert on Colorado liens, Michael Paul, from Colorado. How are you this morning, Michael?
I'm great. How are you, Carolyn?
Good. Happy to be here. So, Michael, tell us a little bit about yourself, how long you've been practicing in this area, and how you got here.
Yeah. So I practice with Dinsmore and Scholl, out of their Denver office. It's a national firm. I've been doing construction law in Colorado since 2005, and got into it with working with subcontractors, and in many cases, filing liens on their behalf. And actually, as my practice evolved, I started working with general contractors and developers as well. And I still work with all three to this day.
Awesome. Exciting. Okay, so my first in the list of questions that I ask every state, do you have to be a licensed contractor to work in Colorado?
You don't. And I know that some of the states near us do require that. But in Colorado, you don't.
And when I ask that, I'm, you know, your normal HVAC guys, electrical and plumbing, still have to be licensed within their trades. But Colorado doesn't have an extra, like, every contractor's got to be licensed in order to get paid or have to sign a contract.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, I know that Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, they do require that, but not.
Awesome. Okay, so then who can have, well, we'll start with private projects. We'll get to public projects towards the end, but who in Colorado can have lien rights?
Yeah, so the statute in Colorado is really broad. It generally applies to anyone who supplies labor, machinery, tools, equipment, and really anything to the construction site, at the request of the owner or the owner's agent. So, and that includes architects, engineers, or other professional or skilled services. So, I think it's fair to say that, you know, virtually anyone who's going to do anything on the project can file a lien.
Awesome. You hit architects and engineers. What about demolition crews?
Yes. Yes. Demolition crews can as well. It's funny because the way the statute's written, it's virtually everyone's going to be an agent of the owner.
Okay.
So for example, if a subcontractor requests materials used in the construction from the material man still has lien rights. So it really passes through to virtually anyone that's working on the site, you know, can lien.
Gotcha. Okay. And so with that, okay, first off, does it matter the actions you have to take to have a valid lien based on your position? Like if you're a GC or a subcontractor or a material supplier, like the further down the chain, is anything different or is it the same?
It's pretty much the same. I think there is some exception when it comes to timing of the lien.
Okay.
So, for example, if you were pretty much a small player on the project and you just provided some labor or work for a very short period of time, or you just kind of wanted piecemeal to file a lien on the project, you have to do that within 2 months of the completion of the improvement. But for everybody else, it's within 4 months. And other than that one nuance, pretty much it doesn't matter your role. It's going to be the same for any instance.
Gotcha. Okay. So if, you know, I want to preserve my lien rights, what are the first steps that I need to take?
Yeah. So the agency that, you know, usually the building department that's going to issue the permit, you're going to need to go to them and have them, you know, issue a notice to the property that, you have a notice of intent to file a lien. And so if you wish to file a lien, you must serve the owner with the notice of intent at least 10 days before you file it, and you work with the building department to do that.
Okay, so it goes through the permitting department to get out. Did the permitting department serve them, or do you serve the owner?
The permitting department does.
Okay, so you go there, and you do they have paperwork, or do you have to fill out your own paperwork?
Actually, I took that back. I apologize. You do actually serve them yourself. You just have to fill out the paperwork at the building department.
Okay, so you fill out the... So they're going to keep a copy. You take your copy, and you serve it on the owner.
That's right.
And, okay, so you can do that any time before, 10 days before you file the lien.
Right.
And then what is the timelines for filing your lien?
Yeah, so after you do that, you're going to file it with the county clerk, and there's a lot of requirements, again, the paperwork you fill out. And again, this is pretty standard, I would presume, nationwide, but you just got to put the owner's name down, the claimant's name, description that's sufficient to identify what exactly the work you did and to lien it. And then you also have to verify that you served it. But after you do those things, you have 4 months from the last day of your work to serve.
4 months from the last day of your work. Is it shortened at all by the completion of the project, or is it just always 4 months?
Always 4 months.
Okay, cool. And so, okay, once you file your lien with the county clerk and it's got the legal description and the amount you're owed, all the good things that are required, do you have to send notice of the lien that was filed to the owner?
Yes.
Yes. And within what time period? Is there a time frame that you need to send it?
You know, actually, it doesn't specifically say that in the statute, but typically, obviously, if you've done the notice of intent and you file it, you normally do it right away.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So the sooner the better. Okay. So in any part in that process, you send your notice, is it required that they receive it to be effective, or is it just sending it? Okay. And can you send it certified mail? Does it have to be personal delivery? What are your notice requirements as far as sending notice?
It has to be certified mail. It has to be verified.
Gotcha. Okay. That's good. Okay, so you do that. And then, so is there any particular rules that are different for homesteads or residential projects at all that apply?
You know, the one exception I would say is that, you know, when you have a residential apartment complex, or up to 4 units, the notice of the agency granting the permit is not required for new residential construction or for residential property containing more than 4 units. So, again, that's just one more exception.
So what does that mean? You'd have to go find the information somewhere else, or?
Well, it's just that when you're talking to the agency, in this case, we're talking about the building department, you know, which is granting granted the permit, that there it's not needed to for new residents, or for a property containing more than 4 units, you don't need to provide the notice.
Okay, so you could. You don't need to provide the notice there. You just have to send it on your own?
Correct.
Okay, gotcha. And so if I have to file my lien within, you know, 4 months of last work, can I do it earlier than that?
Yes. We encourage that. I mean, the one thing I'll say about Colorado courts is that, you know, they really stick hard and fast to these deadlines. So if you're, you know, even a day late, you have no recourse. So the sooner you can get this accomplished, the better.
Yeah. And that, I think that's a good rule of thumb, no matter what state you're in, is that there's no penalty for moving early. If you know that there's an issue, just do it. You don't have to wait. And in my experience, the sooner you do it, the more likely it is to get resolved. Is that in your same experience?
Absolutely. I think that, you know, because then they know that you're serious. You know, you are going to, you're owed money, you want to be paid, and you're not going to just let it go. And I think that the longer you let it go, I think the owner gets the idea that you're willing to walk with that.
Absolutely. And the sooner you do it, the more likely they still have funds owed to the person that owes you money. And when that's the case, it's easier to pay as opposed to when an owner or GC has to pay twice for the same thing.
Exactly. You're the last one to really push back, right? I mean, they're going to pay all the people, you know, that, you know, complain fastest and assert their rights the quickest. So you definitely want to be first in line.
Absolutely. The squeaky wheel gets paid first.
Yep.
That's always what I say. Okay, so once you have your lien filed, how long is it good for?
Good for 6 months.
Okay.
And then you have to file, you know, you must then file a notice that you're going to commence an action.
So basically a lawsuit to foreclose or take some action in the court to keep that lien alive.
That's right.
Gotcha. And just curious, how are your courts in Colorado? Are you guys on schedule? How long does it take to get to trial? How long would a lien case normally take to get decided?
You know, we're extremely backed up. With COVID going on, you know, before pre-COVID, we were already inundated with cases. And, you know, it was very common to have more than a year either case from start of a lawsuit to resolving it. I think it's almost double that now. And so nothing is happening fast. So to our point earlier, when we were talking about asserting your rights right away, moving to, you know, to foreclose on the lien, it's a long process. So the sooner you get started, the better off you'll be.
Gotcha. And so what do you think of arbitration as an alternative?
Well, there's pros and cons in both, right? The district court or arbitration. Arbitration is much faster. You're not going to have to wait as long. You're not obviously going to pick the private arbitrator. It's going to go much quicker. However, you are going to have to pay for that arbitrator's time. And so the expenses involved is something that you really have to take into consideration. But typically, you don't see in Colorado the arbitration route too often. But as these cases continue to back up, I wouldn't be surprised if some.
Yeah, and the other thing that, in my experience, that I like about arbitration is that when I go to district court, I have to explain how the construction industry works, and then I have to explain how the law applies, and then I have to explain our facts on top of that. And sometimes when I get an expert that's familiar with, you know, it's an attorney that's familiar with construction, I can just tell the facts.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it always makes it much easier when you're dealing with someone.
Well, and you don't realize it when you're, because you're in construction, and our clients are in construction all the time. And so they just think everybody thinks like they do, or everybody knows how the process works. And most people have no idea how this industry runs on credit, what a lien is, or why it's important. And so, yeah, it can be an exhausting process to, you know, inform everybody. Absolutely. Okay. So then if we file suit within 6 months, are we allowed to get our attorney's fees back when we file that enforcement suit?
You're not.
Really?
Yeah, you're not. Unless there's something in the contract between the parties that gives you the ability, and then the court will enforce that, and they do pretty rigorously enforce that. But if there's no, you know, prevailing party provision in the contract or another provision that would entitle you to your attorney's fees, you will not get it.
Yeah, so like a material supplier that doesn't have a contract is not going to get his attorney's fees.
That's right.
Gotcha. But even if a subcontractor has it in their contract, the contract's not with the owner. So if he's filing suit to foreclose, he won't get them either.
That's right.
Gotcha. Okay. Gotcha. What about, could you get your court costs or arbitration costs back?
You would get your court costs. Okay. Costs are back. Arbitration, of course, is always it's in the discretion of the arbitrator.
Gotcha. All right, and then back on material suppliers, which this is different in all 50 states, do they have to prove incorporation?
They don't.
Okay, so what are they? Is delivery enough or delivery tickets?
Yeah. So material is going to be valid as long as there's a good faith basis that the materials were incorporated into the project. It's still good practice to me. I always counsel my clients to obtain proof that it was incorporated, just in case they dispute that in the future. But as long as they have a good faith basis, you can go ahead and do that. The one thing is, there's always exceptions when you talk about, like, specially fabricated materials. Can you lien for those if they're not delivered, for example? Yes, you can. And there's actually a specific case here in Colorado, not a statute, that talks about it, and it says that especially fabricated materials can lien, manufacturer those. But you, at least if the material then does deliver, so eventually you still have to deliver the product, but you can lien.
So if they're refusing it, you should just throw it at them.
Yeah, you should say, hey, you know what?
Hey, yeah, I'm dropping this here. It's your problem now.
Well, you know, we have a lot of really expensive areas in Colorado, like Aspen, and everything is custom.
So
they can't. You know, then when you do that, it's upfront. You know, you spend all this money to make this particular item. You can't just give it back. So I mean, it's one of those things where they're going to say, "Hey, I'm going to leave the property. I deserve to get paid for this, and I will eventually give it to you, even if they refuse it." But if you want to get the money, you're going to have to eventually do it.
Gotcha. And so do your notice requirements for that change at all?
No, the exact same.
So, but if we never deliver it, or we haven't delivered it, we'd go from like 4 months from the time it was ordered, or the 4 months it was time being done being fabricated?
Yeah, it's 4 months of when you would have been.
Okay, gotcha. So at the end of fabrication, probably. Gotcha. All right, so is the construction lender at all involved, or can they be involved in the lien process in Colorado?
Yes, they are. In fact, they're a mandatory party. That requires that all parties that are liable for debt
So when you go to the permitting office and you get that initial, you file that original notice of intent, are they going to be on there to receive notice too?
Okay. They are.
And so do they have any liability if you don't get, if the lien claimant doesn't get paid?
No, they don't have the same exposure to you.
So they're put on notice and they're going to try to convince the owner to pay it or take care of it?
That's exactly right.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, because a lot of states don't have anything like that. So I think, especially if you can get a lender involved, that's a lot of leverage, right?
It's one good part about Colorado
statute. Yeah, I agree. I know some states have like a stop payment where if the lender receives a notice, they can't issue any payments at all. But even just getting them informed, because like we have no rights like that here in Texas, I find that if I call a bank and it's a larger bank, they really don't care. A smaller bank might. But if, you know, they're receiving a certified letter and obviously the terms of the note between the owner and the construction lender would put them in a technical default if a lien is filed. You know, so. Okay, can you have a lien on lease space in Colorado? Okay. And so how does that lien look different if you file it, or does it look the same?
It's generally the same. I mean, regardless of, again, the party or the space, it's going to be the same stuff as the outline.
So is the owner liable on that or just the tenant?
It depends.
Okay. No, I got the same thing here. I'm curious. What is it like in Colorado?
Yeah, it just depends on the situation. And I mean, typically, much like we were just talking about the construction lender, I think when you have an owner and the tenant, depending on, you know, who you contracted for the work and so forth and so on, but I think you're going to put them both on notice and you're going to use that as leverage.
Absolutely. What I kind of do, because here in Texas, is if the owner is paying for the improvements or giving a credit for the improvements, then we can have a lien. Unfortunately, as a subcontractor material supplier, you don't get to see the lease. So we have an intent to lien that we have to send up first and request a copy of the lease. And it says, if you don't give it to me, then I'm just going to assume that you're giving money and I'm going to lien the whole thing. So anyways. And because they never give you the lease. They never want to give you the lease. So then I could say, hey, I asked for it. And you just can give it to me. All right. Public projects in Colorado. Can you file a lien on a public project in Colorado?
You cannot. No.
So do they have bonds? And what level do bonds start at?
Yes, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be the bonds. And so, and it just depends on the situation. You know, for the county, city, municipality, school district, for those kinds of contracts, it's got to exceed $50,000. For contracts with the state, it's going to exceed $150,000.
Gotcha. And so do the general contractors get those bonds? And then how can a claimant get a copy of that bond?
You just request it from the contractor. The bond statute requires the contractor, you know, file a notice with the county clerk and post the notice at the site. And also, it requires the contractor provide a copy of it to anyone who requests it.
Is there a timeline on that?
There is not.
Okay. So, all right. And then, so once you have a copy of the bond, you remain unpaid. When do you have to send your notices, and who do you have to send them to have a bond claim?
Yeah, so it's going to be any time before final settlement, the claimant has to file a statement that they're not owed with the board, the officer, or any other entity that awarded the contract. Okay. When that happens, that entity awarding the contract must withhold payment to the contractor sufficient to satisfy the claim. And okay. If the claim remains unsatisfied, the claimant has 90 days after the final settlement to bring an action to enforce it.
Gotcha. So you can actually, it's basically trap funds and a bond claim.
That's exactly right.
Which is kind of nice. Because the federal government doesn't require that, and in Texas we don't require that either. So you have, and obviously, it's great leverage when you're holding up the GC's money if you want to get paid. Awesome. Good deal. Okay. So that's public works. Super easy in Colorado, man. But okay, so having dealt with subcontractors all over the construction industry, I want to get, I'm trying to take a poll here of everybody I talk to about what do you think about the status of subcontracts?
In what regard?
Like, are they effective? Yes. I mean, no, I'm looking at it from the perspective of a subcontractor and being... Do they really understand what they're signing? Do they know what they're supposed to do?
Yeah, you know, that's such a great question. And, you know, I think that so often subcontractors just sign whatever's put in front of them, and they don't really give a lot of thought to how that's going to affect them, what rights they're waiving, and frankly, how lopsided the contracts are in favor of the general contractor or even an owner of that. And so, I know I constantly counsel my clients to come talk to me before they sign anything, and or better yet, let us develop our own contract that kind of evens the playing field. But for the most part, that's just not in their DNA. They typically just go ahead and sign things anyway.
No, I know, and that's so much a part of, I don't know if they just think there's a set of rules out there that protect them. And here's, you know, because I'm dealing a lot with this now, and I think, you know, if you've never had an issue, I'm so happy for you. But if you do, it's going to hurt, right? Because those contracts put all kinds of teeth and dangerous things in there. And you don't know it when you sign it, right? And it's not till there's a misstep that everything in that is used against you. And I think what has happened, us as attorneys took on the job of writing a subcontract from the perspective of the GC and trying to protect them wholly, thinking that there would be a negotiation. And there just never was. And now we have these one-sided documents that, I mean, I don't know about you, but they've gotten worse over the years.
No, they're terrible. And again, you know, having the subs add GC as an additional insured, you know, defense and identity, and so forth and so on. And I also think just what's left out of those contracts so often is the scope of work. That is the most important thing because, but that's the whole point of the contract. If you don't have any contract, that's dangerous because the GC can just make up what your scope of work is. But if you have a contract and you don't specify that, or you're very, very vague, you really have done a disservice to the sub because the sub needs to say, look, I only did X. And if there is any changes, there should be a change order. Don't do it verbally because you get yourself in a world of trouble there too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the other thing that I come across is that subs always think that they're hired to do their bid, and that normally doesn't even become part of the contract, and so we get in dangerous situations there. So I'm just kind of taking everybody's temperature on the subcontract because I really think that we can do a better job. Even, don't be wrong, I think there's two issues with the subcontract right now. Is that number one, nobody can understand them. I mean, even lawyers, it takes us freaking a week to understand what you're trying to say, and it doesn't have to be that way. And number two is that it puts 100% of the risk and liability on the subs, which I'm not saying they shouldn't have some, but it should be, we should split it, right? And so even if we could deal with one of those things and just put it in a way that if a subcontractor wanted to know what he was agreeing to, he could read it by himself, you know, I think that would be helpful.
It really would. That's the whole thing. I think subcontractors are very busy. They've got a lot of different projects going on. You know, something simple, straightforward, that's in plain English is what they're looking for, and not something they can't understand. So I agree. I just think it's unfortunate that the way, more often than not, the general contractor that has the lawyer that's drafted the contract, really lopsided, and it's very difficult to understand. So usually I tell my subcontractors, it takes one time in the suit when they fully understand finally what the gravity is and what they sign. And from that point forward, either A, they come to me and we draft up the contract they like and can live with, or B, I just say, please, 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 let me look at it first before you sign.
Yeah, even if you don't negotiate anything, just figure out what it says, right? So you know what you're agreeing to. So if you know what you're agreeing to, then you can evaluate the risk. And like I said, I know that you're busy. We're here to help you guys do this because we really want you to run successful businesses at the end of the day. That's what it's all about. And there's just so much danger in there. So anyways, that's my soapbox. I wrote a book, Quit Getting Screwed, which is all about the dangerous terms and subcontracts put in plain English. So if you ever, I'm sure it's most of the stuff that you face on a daily basis that are in the subcontract that I've seen bite my clients over and over again. There's 20 different chapters and all the things I've just seen happen. So anyways, but thank you so much, Michael, for being here. And like I said, we'll put your contact information and all the things in the show notes. If anybody wants to reach out to you directly, I appreciate it. I appreciate that while filing a lien is so easy in Colorado. Nice. And you have lots of ways to create leverage to get paid fast. So, but thanks again for being here so much, Michael. Have a great day. Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Tune in 2 weeks from now for a new episode. Thank you.